Okay, so we got to verse 7. Well, I hope that was useful to some of you, as we're just starting to scratch the surface here in Ephesians. And we're going to, look, we're going to get to the next verse. That's, for by favor you've been saved from belief, through belief. So, oh, yeah, there's the verse. It's also going to be interesting, right? We get to that one again. In verse 8. All the Christians use that verse to try to undermine anything, right? Oh, no, you're saved by faith. Okay? By grace you've been saved through belief and not of yourselves. It's a gift. It is a gift. But do you understand what that means? And we'll talk about it again next week. All right, so this is the afterburn. I left myself a great place to start next time, so that'll be a good place to launch right into. Look, that's kind of the beauty of just going until the clock says you've gone long enough, and then you stop wherever you are. I wasn't planning to stop there. I didn't know where I was going to stop, so it worked out, I think, very nicely. So now I can sweat it out for a week trying to figure out how to answer that verse. No, I've answered that verse many times. That was a tough verse when I didn't understand grace properly. It's a very tough verse. Okay, so that being said, this is the afterburn. So we're going to take questions, comments, thoughts, etc. And hopefully I might answer a few of them. We'll see how that goes. If you're here locally, you can line up over behind Shamish Waffle, who always seems to get up there fast and first. Probably helps that he holds the microphone. And then, of course, we have our live stream desk with our Shamish team back there. All right. While you're busy breaking your headset, go ahead and ask your question.
I just want to see if I clarify. I had maybe a comment on Ephesians 1:4, where it talked about us being blameless. And we're blameless in Messiah, but only if we're in covenant. Otherwise, it doesn't apply to us. So that's like the spirit of the meaning, and it definitely doesn't include us being blameless from our actions.
All right, well, look, you bring up a good point. I don't know how well I covered it earlier. I'll have to go back and see, because I don't have any notes for this. But look, if you are dealing with a person, okay, maybe it's an employee that you just hired, maybe it's your child dealing with something that they've not experienced before, or a new employee doesn't understand how things work in your office, and they do something that they shouldn't do. And they say to you, I had no idea. I wouldn't have done. I didn't know. And if that's legitimate, are they really to be blamed? So this idea of being blameless is talking to those who should know. He wants you to be blameless because you should know. What brings blame? Okay? Because if I bring a child into a situation they've never been in before, or an employee or anybody into a situation where somebody new comes to this building and doesn't know some of our protocols. Like, we have a protocol, no drinks in this room unless it's got a closable, it's got to have a sealable, closable lid. No open drinks. Okay, somebody walks in, they brought a cup of coffee with them, whatever, and they don't have that, and they don't know. And let's say nobody caught them, and then it spills or something, and then somebody's going to go get mad and start blaming them. What's wrong with you? Don't you know we have this rule? No, they didn't know. And so then I still might be a little frustrated with the spill, right? A person may still, but can I really blame them? Okay? So when he wants us to be blameless, he's talking about the people. Again, context is everything. Who's he talking to? It said, the set-apart ones who are in Ephesus and true to Messiah. You guys, be blameless. Because you guys know what brings blame. All right. Steve?
And then in 1:6, it said esteem of his favor. So I think you kind of touched on it a little bit, but that's unmerited, correct? But not really the grace thing, because there's a difference between salvation and reward, correct?
Well, no, this is literally just talking about favor. Where he's saying, look, he says, having previously ordained us to adoption as sons through Messiah, according to the good pleasure of his desire, to the praise of the esteem of his favor, like he's giving us benefit, he's benefiting us, favor, okay, with which he favored us in the beloved. So he's sometimes favor just means favor. I've done something to your benefit. Whether you merited it or not, I've done something to your benefit. You did not merit having your bubble popped, okay? Which is where we get into salvation being a free gift. Even the bubble popping is a free gift. Now, what you do with it then decides what kind of reward you get. There's a gift, though, to start you off. He gifts you with a starting point. He gifts you with the understanding of the ending point. You know, anybody can pick up a Bible and get most of this stuff just because these things are everywhere. They just pick it up and read it. But he lets you know that I've made these things available to you. But when you look at it, sometimes favor just means favor. That's why I like that they actually put the word favor here. It just means I'm going to favor you with something. I like you, I'm going to give you something. Okay? So he says here that he favored us with the favor which he favored us in the beloved. In other words, he blessed us, he gave us this gift, or he did us a favor and put us in with the Messiah. This is a tremendous favor for us. We couldn't do that ourselves. So he did it for us. Remember, I told you, he doesn't do anything you have to do, but he does the things that you can't do. You can't bring yourself to Messiah. None comes as the Father draws. None. Period. That's it. End of story. All right, anything else?
I just had to say something about your zombie comment because you don't know how truthful your statement really is, because there's a lot of people out there alive but not living.
That's true. I do know how truthful that was. All right. Now, shockingly, Janet is next.
So when you were talking about reading how Shaul was asking for wisdom and understanding to the people of Ephesus, I was thinking about, like, for us, I mean, we receive his wisdom and understanding through you, right? I mean, you're the one who is pouring that on us so you can help us become complete, like you were saying later. And, you know, like chapter 4, he gave us the people, to the leaders, to be able to become one and be complete in him in the body. But my question is, when it says wisdom and understanding, and it says his wisdom and understanding, I was thinking about, that will mean, that, what it means really is, like, we will have his mind. Like, is that what it's talking about, like having the mind of Messiah?
Sure.
That, okay.
Sure.
And with that along, what I hear from you a lot is that we're supposed to be walking toward with the fruits of the Spirit. So this morning I was meditating, and one of the things that I got from him was that, like, Elder Billy always says, keep your focus on him and look at him when you're encountering different situations. So having his mind will also mean trying to exhibit the fruits in each situation, even if it's not what you want to do. Like, sometimes you don't want to express the joy or the patience or whatever, but that's what he wants us to do. And that will be, that's what the process of becoming complete in him will look like. Like, we have to, like you were talking about how we were walking in the flesh and now we're doing more. We know more and now we have the responsibility to do more. But part of doing more is not just the mechanics, but it's also the choosing to be joyful, patient, or kind, or whatever when we're supposed to, and we don't want or we don't feel like doing it.
Well, I think you kind of grasped that pretty good. I think you got the handle on that. I mean, this is where the biggest challenge is what do we do with the things that we really don't necessarily have that much excitement to do,
right?
But then we do them anyway. You know, as we become more in tune with the mind of Messiah, at least we'll start off understanding what should be going on, like how we should be thinking, or maybe, should this situation have joy? I know I don't feel any joy, but I might be aware that it should have joy. Then I can make a choice to bring joy into it and feel joy, even though that was not my first choice. But I have to start having that mind of Messiah to go, you know what, this is a trial. Maybe you should have some joy in this trial. What? Okay, but that's his mind, not mine, right? Now, as I change mine into his, that thought should come up much more often, and then I can understand how to bring joy into the trial, mm-hmm. How I can love an enemy.
Yes.
Okay, how you can do all these things with the fruit of the Ruach. Yes. But you have to let his mind be in there, which starts off with an awareness level. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay,
so it feels like I got it. And then I just had a question and a comment. So I'll go with a comment first. So initially when you were starting your teaching today, you always t- tell us, okay, this is, you're supposed to be set apart, consecrated for his purpose, right? And do it in a very discernible, open way. So this morning, or it was yesterday, my daughter Valentina, she was telling me that she was supposed to work until, I don't know, 3 or 4, but the manager came to her because apparently somebody was sick, and he's like, are you able to stay working later? And then he asked her, what time is sundown? My daughter was like, okay, so she knew it was around 8:30 or so, but the question, you know, that was super cool from the manager to ask her, what time is sundown? Because he knew that obviously she cannot go beyond that point. So that was kind of cool because he gets it. He's doesn't walk anything, but it's so awesome. Cool when you're really like doing it and then people start to notice it and then they kind of expect that, and that's so cool. But anyway, my question was about chapter 2. And then you were talking about, I think it was verse 3.
Oh, by the way, let me just interrupt. Oh. Anybody should be able to come up to you on Friday. If they ask you, you shouldn't have to look it up. You should know what time Friday sundown is. You should have looked it up at least that morning so you plan your day right, knowing what time sundown is. You shouldn't have to look it up. Okay, now I know a lot of us probably do, so I'm encouraging you. You get to Friday, one of the things you do first thing that morning is look on your phone and figure out what time sundown is. And if your phone says sundown is 8:30, that's good, because sundown is going to be not dark yet, but it's going to be when the sun just goes below the horizon. And so that's a good time for you to start, even though it's not dark yet. Now, as far as sundown finishing Shabbat, let's add another 15 minutes, please, so that it actually is dark. Okay? Start earlier. Because remember, they're not going by some scientific thing. They're looking when the sun went down and it got dark outside. That's how they knew it was sundown. So let's go with, especially if you're in the mountains or any place that's different, the sun's not going to be going, it's going to get dark at a different rate because it's you're higher up, it's lower down, and that kind of thing. So let's try to start a little early, finish a little late, and catch Shabbat. I mean, having a longer Shabbat's a good thing, yes? Okay.
And thank you, Rabbi, for that. Yes, what you were saying, doing with the utmost, right? Do more, not less. I love that. Rabbi, I had a question, chapter 2, verse 4. The part where he says that he has his rage and compassion and because of his great love with which he loved us. So it's just amazing to me, if you can expand on this, how he created us and he loved us even though we haven't done anything to merit that love, that type of love that he had to love us. So can you expand on that, please?
All right, so it's like a parent that you would understand. To give you an analogy we could do is, as a parent, you love your child. Hopefully you love your child. Even when your child isn't being so lovable, or when they're extremely hard to love. Okay, I've not had that problem really. But I mean, I know people that have had that kind of a problem where you could be really tough. You have children that are doing some really challenging things for you to deal with. But yet you still love them. And so he's saying is, you were in trespass, you were sinning, you were doing all these things, he said, and so it's in the richness of his compassion because of his great love with which he loved us. Us, not just us, the chosen ones, us, all people. The great love he has for those he created, he had a plan for you. That even in your, I mean, look at how he loved the children of Israel. And even though he scattered them, he says, I will bring you back because of my great love for you and my promise to your forefathers. And so there's a description here of the compassion and his great love with which he loved us, not to be, you know, misunderstood as being them specifically, but this is the plan for everybody. He loves everybody with this compassion and great love that at some point he pops their bubble and gives them their opportunity to have the revelation of the knowledge of him in its truth, right? Not just what they think they know about him, but what they really need to know about him. One other thing for Janet. So she said something about you guys receiving things from me. You don't receive anything from me. Okay, I'm the one sharing things with you. The receiving is you, the Ruach in you. That all the receiving's on your side. Okay? Because she said, well, we're all receiving this from you. I said, no, I'm sharing with you. Whether you receive it or not, that's on you. So you can say that I'm giving these things to you. I can go ahead and give you something, and then you can not take it, or you can take it and put it down. You can take it and throw it away. So the receiving is on you. And that's where the ruach in you and you together decide to receive or not. Okay? I think it's really important. Because people say, well, we receive all this stuff from you. Well, maybe you did, maybe you didn't. Maybe you did receive. So I'm not saying she's wrong to say that. For her, maybe she does receive it. But that's not because I shared, I gave. The receiving is not what you do. Okay, does that help a little bit? All right, Isaiah.
I was going to ask you a question. Is it possible to have emunah and be afraid to do what Yahweh wants? And then you answered it, like right after I asked the question with... Ephesians 1:19. It says, and what is the exceeding greatness of his power toward us who are believing according to the working of his mighty strength. Wait, time out. I want to tell you, in all of the different teachings, I've had so many different teachings out of Ephesians, and all the way, thank you very much for the teaching, because the way you rightly divided the whole word over what we were reading through, I think that was phenomenal. So the part about receiving revelation through what you're teaching, thank you very much. Thank you, Abba. Amen.
Awesome.
Yeah, you can clap for that.
That's my line. You can clap for that.
And in looking at it, I made myself forget my question over this. You know, it's, just going through how, you know, it continues to kind of vacillate. You were dead in your trespasses and sins, but now, you know, then and now, this contrast and comparison. But it appears as though that verse is kind of like preemptively revealing that it is through believing that the working of his mighty strength does all these things that Shaul is laying out, what has been done and is being done for them. You know, so kind of like answering my own questions in my mind. You know, there was a lot of doorways kind of open in my life when I was, you know, walking according to the course of the world, according to the ruler of the authority of the air and the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Because it's like bubble pop, bubble pop, bubble pop, bubble pop, bubble pop. It keeps happening. There's a lot of layers of bubbles,
right?
You know, and it's not, but at the event that I had that I called getting saved, salvation, it was never an altar call, but it was very real for me. And my nature didn't change, but it was confronted with another nature that
started the journey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like, no, it didn't. It was all of a sudden I'm confronted with this. All of this stuff in your life is wrong, basically, that I guess has brought me to this place where I need to be in verse 5. Wait, sorry. The way you laid out. Let me read real fast.
Well, while you're reading, the idea of the mighty strength, hold your thought. Don't lose it this time. Hold your thought. The idea of the mighty strength. How many of you are willing to admit that you were not the easiest person for him to get the attention of? Okay? So there was some mightiness of strength there. Okay? Because he was like, excuse me, hey. Instead, next thing you know, he's grabbing you and saying, I'm trying to get your attention. So that took a little bit. Some of us are a little bit tough to get our heads wrapped around somebody trying to get a hold of us, him getting a hold of us, right? And so that's part of this as well. You know, we could be a little bit, he said, look, I'm calling this one. This is going to be a work right here. But it's your time. So here we go. Roll up the sleeves. we're going to war. We're going to get this fixed. I'm going to get your attention. Go ahead.
Oh, man. it was chapter 2, verse 8. For by favor you have been saved through belief, and that not of yourselves is the gift of Elohim.
Well, but that's next week. Well, go ahead. You can do it anyway.
Oh, wait. No, you didn't go read that. Why
nope.
did I?
It was
You're
verse
dead.
It was verse 5 that you were thinking of.
Yeah, verse 5, the way I did whatever. Yeah. Okay. But you know that who had like gone through a process where I'm confronted with this nature that has, that's like the first bubble pop, I guess. I would have to say that's like, you know, where people went, where did you first get saved? Well, really where I first had my first bubble pop was where I was confronted all this. It was like I had this nature that's confronting my nature that is dead in trespasses and sins.
So use delivered, because delivered means that you were taken out of something. Okay, as opposed to saved sounds like a status, because that's the way Christianity's taught us. So you were in a place in your life where you were delivered, or at least shown a way out of that place. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that was a critical moment where you were delivered out of something. They were delivered out of Egypt, and the journey had barely begun. I mean, there was so much more to happen, but they were delivered out of slavery. They weren't saved. They were delivered out of that. And then there was more things that they needed to be delivered out of all the time, and including for us, ignorance, stupidity, foolishness, selfishness, and all this other junk that we deal with, right? Okay? And so so you absolutely, all of you, I'm sure, can point to a moment where he delivered you out of something, a lifestyle, a mindset, a path you were on, a direction, something. Those are critical moments. Thing is, if we start using the lingo and the lexicon of Christianity, it creates a connection to the what they say it means. And so sometimes we can start thinking that, well, I was saved. No, you were delivered out of something. Mm-hmm. Now, given the potential for full salvation's benefits, salvation was made available to you a long time ago, like it was for everybody when Yeshua died and was resurrected. However, there was no real understanding of how to take advantage of that for what it was intended to do for you until he delivered you and started this process in his great love of revealing himself to you. And that moment we can remember. Okay, that's a powerful moment. I remember the moment, you know, in my life. I remember when, you know, all of a sudden I was aware that there's more and some of it's up there and I need to figure that out. And I know that moment. I'm not saying there may have been other moments where it kind of went in and out the ear, but there was a moment where I knew I needed to know this. I knew something was wrong, something was missing. The same journey happened to me, happened to everybody, you know?
Amen. See, I would say delivered to obedience, mm-hmm. exactly like them. Mm-hmm. Delivered to be shown how to live. Amen. Thank you, Father.
Amen. All right, so again, as Isaiah was pointing out, in chapter 1, he lays out, I'm so proud of you where you are now, but let's remember where you came from and how you got here. So we're going to go backwards in time. You were dead in your trespasses, and now we're going to watch the journey all the way to where he says, now in verse 13, in Messiah, you who are far off are brought near. So we're going to go from this is where you are now, but let's remember how we got there so that we don't end up back there again. Okay, this is like saying, you were in Egypt, let's not go back to Egypt. Well, you were dead in your trespasses and acting like the world and disobedient, let's not. Okay, and of course, you could be disobedient to anything you didn't know that you're being disobedient to, but you had this self-sovereignty where you were just doing what you wanted, which made you disobedient to anything else. Okay, all right, Heather.
Hi, Rabbi. I was hoping you could help me with the bouncy ball going on in my head. You were talking about, like, if somebody were to come in here and they didn't know about having a closed container spill, can't blame them. And I get it, but there's a, I guess, an action or a reaction to every action. Mm-hmm. So the spill happens, right?
Yep.
It's like you, a child doesn't know it's going to be a hot stove, but they touch it, they're going to get burned.
Oh, yeah.
So I think my question is, I want to get it in order. Yahweh put things in place before the foundation of the earth. Part of that was Torah to give us these guardrails. And without knowledge or knowing or without our eyes being open to that, we're not really, it's not called sin necessarily, but there's still going to be consequence. Right? Is it
right,
aligning this?
Look, the problem is we're tripping over the idea of being blameless, right? We're not blaming. That doesn't mean something bad doesn't happen, okay? Okay, child doesn't know that doing such and such may be dangerous. They do it and they get hurt. Okay, I'm not going to blame the child, but the consequence is still there. They got hurt. Or they broke something that was expensive. I never told the child not to play with that. Next thing you know, they're playing with it and they broke it. So I want to blame the child. Well, the child didn't know. I never told the child this. Consequence is still there. The thing is broken. All right? So yes, there's always consequences that Abba has built into the system. The thing is, we didn't know that the consequences were connected to a relationship with him as well, because he hadn't revealed that. Like, he hadn't shown us the guardrails and the boundaries and the lines that we could cross over. So the boundaries of trespass, right? Don't go over here. Stay on this side. Don't do this. Do this. All the do's and don'ts, right? The positive and negative commandments. And so the consequences are still there. I mean, almost all of us that were in verse 1 of chapter 2, we lived lives with lots of consequences, which is why we were probably excited about finding that there was a better way. But it took us a while to realize that the other way didn't work very well. And we were pretty stubborn to make sure that we were going to figure out a way to make it work as best we could until we realized it just doesn't work. Okay? Which is why he allows you to end up flat on your back. It's easier to look up that way. Okay? Okay? Sometimes the people think, like, why would he let me end up here? Because now you're looking up. Okay, when you're standing up, you're not looking up. But when you're flat on your back, just destroyed, all you can do is look up. Okay?
And I think this is related, but, like, I had a conversation with my uncle many years ago before I was on this journey, before Abba brought me to the realization of the truth of his Torah. But it was interesting to me that what my uncle said was, I don't believe that, you know, if there's this good God, that he would allow people who really have this intention to be good, that he would allow them, and back then it was, you know, go to hell, or that he wouldn't love them. And, you know, I brought up, like, well, how do you define good? Whose measure is that you're defining good?
Right.
And I didn't know then the Torah, but I had some idea that I knew.
Well, your uncle was right, okay? I mean, it would be really tough to believe in a God that would just punish people who were doing things they didn't even know were wrong and torture them in any kind of way. So I would agree with him 100%. The thing is that there actually is a different plan in the book than what Christianity has told us. And so that plan is the consequences that we really need to worry about, the second death, that kind of thing, is from being in full awareness and still choosing to do the things you shouldn't do. As opposed to the unfairness of, well, what if you had never been told any of this stuff? That's so unfair. And you're right, that would be so unfair. But yet, that's not the way the plan is in the book. The plan is not unfair. The plan only has in it that those consequences that are so, you know, eternal, so to speak, are for those that are aware and make choices. And so, you know, I applaud your uncle and many of us who deal with people and even ourselves. I always had a big problem with the idea that there would be this sort of, you know, all right, so when you look at Christianity has this idea that if you don't know Messiah, you're done. And therefore, we have the pressure of running around the world trying to tell everybody about Messiah. So basically, the poor slob that happens to live somewhere where they never get to hear this, he's just done for no reason. That seems to me to be a somewhat of a not righteously balanced, fair, you know, respecter of persons problem, okay? So you're special, you got to know, and this guy who lived in some country where they never heard about this, that whole, everybody that lived there is just done? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Which is why the Millennium and Kingdom teaching is so important, to explain how everybody gets that one chance. And if not now, in the millennium. Okay? Because that would be fair. Okay? And we have 400 verses where it says that he is fair. He is just. He judges righteously. He's not a respecter of persons. And so this is helping to also understand. So look, you are in a different place now. You are set apart. You are called. You've made choices. You were dead in your trespasses. And in the abundant love and compassion, you were drawn to Messiah to learn how you can get reconciled and be part of the covenant and promises as it talks about in verse 12, which we'll talk about next week, right? But until then, you were excluded from them. But not as a punishment. Nobody gets to be included until he chooses. And when he chooses, and I have confidence that he will choose a moment for everybody. Now, some of you are thinking, oh, but I have parents that died and they didn't, this may not have been their moment. There's a thing called the millennium. They'll get their moment. Okay? Well, that sounds like second chance theology. Listen to the teaching, okay? It's not second chance anything. They'll have their moment. But what you need to be afraid of in a right way or take seriously is that this is your moment. Okay, this is your moment. He says, judgment is now on the house of Elohim. We're the house of Elohim. Judgment is now. Not, you know, who knows when he's going to. You are being watched. Everything's being recorded. And you're going to have to answer for what you do. Because you're not dead in your trespasses. You're not walking according to the course of the world. And you're not just sitting there in complete ignorance with no, as it says in verse 12, at that time, you were without Messiah, excluded from citizenship, strangers to the covenants, etc. No, now you've been brought near through the blood. Now you've been brought near through him popping your bubble and drawing you to him and showing you the way, the path to righteousness and to relationship, to right relationship. So now judgment is on you now. So now what you do actually matters. It didn't matter until now. And then you're thinking, well, I wish he'd have left me alone because then it wouldn't matter. I understand. But that was never going to happen forever. In other words, if not now, then in the millennium, he was going to do this to you. Okay? So you aren't going to escape the moment where you know and you have to choose. There's no escaping that. You are going to have to know and choose. Because some of you are thinking, well, maybe ignorance is bliss. No. It means you're going to have to do this all over again. And by the way, I think it was quite fun enough the first time. I think we can all agree. Okay? And it really was, and it really wasn't. I mean, we have our moments that were. We've enjoyed ourselves. But there was, nobody wants to do this again. Okay? I don't know anybody that wants to do this twice. All right? And so that's... You know, that's maybe what some people end up getting to do as they have not lived a life with an opportunity with their eyes open, or maybe the word was not given to them where they lived in that century where they were even aware of Torah and Messiah. Huge parts of the world that didn't have access to it. We did not have the internet, you know, until what, the last 50 years, 40 years, not even 30 years? I mean, it's been so short. It seems like a long time, but really, it's only been 30 years, maybe 20, 30 years. I remember in college, when my brother was dealing with the internet for the first time it existed, and it was only between colleges they were talking to each other. And he was communicating with someone at Yeshiva University in Jerusalem, which was one of the few schools that were on the internet. And it was a college by college thing. It wasn't, you know, anything like what we have today. And so you go back hundreds of years, information didn't travel very fast. You wanted to go to another country and another part of the world? It took months. Months. Missionaries went to China from, say, Spain. That took them months. If they made it. It was an arduous journey to go through all these places they had to go through to get from one place to the other. Now I can be on Zoom with people all over the world and we're having instantaneous communication. In other words, no lag time. I'm talking, they're talking, I'm seeing them respond. It's like we're sitting in the same room. Didn't have that. So sure, there was lots of people that have lived who've never heard of any of this stuff. Are they just the unlucky ones who are like, too bad on you. You didn't get a chance. That doesn't make any sense. And so, all right, we do need to get to the live streamer, so Chris, you will be last. So let's see if we can get you done quickly.
Okay. So in chapter 1, verse 11, it says that we obtained an inheritance And then in verse 14, it says, it's talking about the pledge of our inheritance, so implying that we haven't gotten our inheritance yet. And then in verse 17, says, or actually 18, knowing what these different things are, including the riches of the esteem of his inheritance. So I want to know how that works with the timing, I guess, and also if that knowing of the expectation and knowing the riches, if that's more informational, or if we want to know, like, have a relationship with the expectation and have a relationship with the riches of the esteem.
All right, look, if you want to understand the riches of the inheritance, you got to go see a probate attorney. I'm kidding. All right, no, seriously. So it starts off saying you've obtained an inheritance. In other words, you come to be in a position where you have an inheritance. You've obtained it. Not that you've actually received it yet, but you found out, by the way, you have an inheritance in your future. Then we're told that there is a pledge of that inheritance, okay, in verse 14. And then we get to 17, was it 17 or, you know, 18, and it talks about what are the riches and the esteem of his inheritance. So now we're getting some details about what the inheritance really is. So we're told, by the way, you didn't know this, but you have an inheritance. You've obtained the information to know that you're now qualified for the inheritance. We were trying to figure out who the heirs were for this inheritance, and you're one of them. And there's a pledge of that inheritance. And then we have the riches of the esteem, in other words, the glory and the honor of the inheritance. Because part of the inheritance is that you are going to be esteemed and honored like they are esteemed and honored. They're going to transfer their honor onto us. Does that help? All right, good. Otherwise, go see the probate attorney. Okay. Okay, Rob? Shamus Rob.
Okay, from Lazarus, Ephesians 1, verse 5. What is the difference between
Lazarus, this? Come forth. Sorry, I just had to do that.
What is the difference between this form of adoption discussed in this verse and Orthodox conversion? It appears one group is obligated to do more than the native-born and the ger.
Okay, adoption is not conversion, okay? This is, I think, an important distinction. The Orthodox are looking to get you to make commitments that will convince them that you're making this choice to go into Orthodox Judaism from wherever you were doing before. Okay, so if you're a Gentile, now you want to be a Jew. First of all, they're going to make it arduous because they really don't want you to do it. Adoption is simply saying that if you're in covenant, covenant is not a complex thing. Covenant is, do you agree to do everything I say? And if you do, you can be covenanted with me, which then makes you, by virtue of covenant, adopted. Okay? Because those that are in covenant are his children. He says in John 1, it says, these he gave the right to call themselves children of the living Elohim. And so it's a much simpler process. The conversion process of the Orthodox is very different. When you look at the native-born and the ger, which is in, you see this in Exodus 12, you see this in many places, dealing with the stranger. The ger is the proselyte, the one wanting to become like the native-born. All they must do is do what the native-born do, which is keep covenant. And then they become as the native-born. The Orthodox are going to want to put you through the ringer to make sure that you, A, really want to do this, and B, understand what you're doing. Okay? It's just because they don't want you to do it. I'm not picking on them. I'm just saying they don't really want people to convert. But because people do want to from time to time, they came up with a process so that it could work. It's just it's a long and arduous process because they're trying to get you to quit and not do it. Okay, they're not interested in padding their numbers or proselytizing or, you know, going out there and evangelizing, unless it's to other Jews, that they'll do. They'd love to convert all the other Jews from whatever belief, what flavor of Judaism they're in, into their orthodoxy, okay? And for that, there's no conversion. It's just getting you to start coming and attending and doing their stuff. Okay, so there is no conversion for that. They're just going to get you to be doing the halacha the way they do the halacha. Okay? So then you're walking as they walk. All right, next.
Okay, Wayne Delaney says, can the seal be broken when you were once sealed through the Ruach HaKodesh?
Okay, again, the seal is not what you're thinking it is. The seal does not guarantee anything. It simply means you've now been selected. It's like if you were in a factory and you're going along the line and you're now sealed, I put a stamp on you that says you've been chosen. Okay? Now, something can happen to you between there and the end of the process, but you've been sealed, you were selected, you have a stamp of approval on you that you were supposed to be chosen. Not approval meaning you're now perfect and wonderful, but you were one actually selected. So hopefully that clarified that a little bit. Because this person is probably still struggling with that whole once saved, always saved thing that people sort of drift towards. They want some sort of guarantees. How do I have assurance? You know, it's called, that eternal, assurance, that eternal security. When I first did the Are You Safe teaching, I had somebody with us at the time who seems to have disappeared off the map. I haven't seen him doing any teaching anywhere, but he hates me. But anyway, that's okay. But he hated me because of this teaching. Because he came from a vineyard background and he had this once saved, always saved mindset, and he absolutely thought that it was the most depressing teaching that he'd ever heard because it took away his eternal security. And I said, I'm sorry, I didn't take away anything. You never had it. Didn't exist. Okay? You have eternal assurances that if you do what you're supposed to do, you'll get what you're supposed to get, and the promises will come true. If you do. You can trust that and have total security in that. Question is, what are you going to do? You don't have any guarantees based on you didn't do anything yet. So how do I know? I mean, Abba's looking at you going like, I'm happy to offer you the prize behind door number 3. But you have to walk over, go through the obstacles, make it through the mazes, and get to the door and open it. But I'm happy to give you what's behind there. But I'm not just going to go there, open the door, take it out, and bring it over to you and hand it to you. Okay? You have to go through the journey. If you go through the journey and do the things that you have to do, then you're going to get there, right? Okay? It's funny. My father was a computer programming teacher at one point as part of what he did. And he used to love to go into like a high school and give the children some sort of an idea about programming. Okay? Now, this is way, we're talking when computers were the sizes of the walls, okay? Not like a laptop and a phone. Like, what your phone can do was more than like a whole room of machines could do. And this is in the 70s, when they were just starting with computers. And so he would give them a sheet, and the sheet would have instructions. Okay, do this. I said, first thing, read everything through. Second thing is, put your name at the top of the page. Third thing was, do this. Fourth thing was, do that. Fifth thing was, stand up and say your name out loud. And so people are doing all of these things. What was the first step? Read everything through. Then what the last thing said? Now that you've read everything through, just do this. The rest of the stuff you weren't necessarily supposed to do. But again, it's about following through instructions. If that first instruction hadn't been that way, then yes, you should have done each thing. So following through and understanding instructions. So take that first instruction out. That paper is like what we need to do. He says, I've sealed you with an approval. You do have an inheritance, but you have to do all the things on this paper to receive your inheritance. You have to learn how to keep Shabbat. You need to keep kashrut. You have to, keep the feast. You got to learn to love your neighbors yourself. You need to treat people with the fruit of the Spirit. These are things you have to do or you're not getting the prize. However, until I sealed you, there was no prize for you to get anyway. Does that make any sense? But now that I've sealed you, you have an opportunity to get the prize. And by the way, there's not just one prize and nobody else gets to have it. Anybody that finishes this process gets to have the same prize. There's enough for everybody. But you have to finish the process. You have to do the things on the expectations list that he has. I expect you to love me with everything you've got, and I expect you to love each other with as neighbor as yourself. I expect the two great commands. I expect you to understand Mashiach. I expect you to get the halacha correctly so you can walk correctly. Okay? I've been hanging out with my Orthodox friends sometimes, and so the halacha. Because you're like, well, does he mean halacha? Well, it's halacha. All right. So there's an expectation that he has to give you a prize. It starts off with, there is no prize till I pick you as a contestant. And that's the ceiling. Okay, you've been chosen. You have a golden ticket that says you are allowed to play the game of eternal life. Here's a ticket. You're sealed. You're approved for the game. All right? Everybody gets to win who finishes. So you're not competing against anybody. And by the way, here is my expectations for you. Do these, follow the instructions, and you'll get the prize. And by the way, I'm going to give you people to help guide you with this. We'll get to chapter 4. We'll talk about that more. Okay, go ahead, Rob.
From Kevin Newkirk, how do you know if you're in the quote-unquote zombie stage or just or truly walking this out?
It depends on your desire to eat brains. If that's not very strong, you're probably not a zombie. I'm sorry, say that again. I've been going since 10 o'clock this morning. What do you want from me? Okay. We had zone two this morning. Go ahead.
He said, how do you know if you're in the quote-unquote zombie stage or truly walking this out?
Look, because it has to do with your awareness of and then your effort to come into covenant, okay? In other words, the zombie stage was you were dead in your trespasses. You didn't know there was anything else to do. You didn't know there was any expectations. Look, my first prayer that was of any value, as far as I could tell, was when I was 22 years old, and I came to realize, long story short, that there may just be something vertical going on that I became aware that I might need to figure out. And so my prayer was simple. If you exist, I was dead in my trespasses, didn't know anything. I was raised as a Jew, sure, I went to Hebrew school and I got bar mitzvah and everything, but it was a secular Jewish, cultural Jewish, I knew the minimum things to function, okay? So if I walked into a synagogue, I could pray, I could read the Hebrew, I could do those things, but we were keeping nothing, my family. So in my prayer, I said, look, if you exist, which I would have no idea, then you're gonna have to show yourself to me in some way. And if there's something I should be doing, I won't know. At this point, I have no idea. If there's something I shouldn't be doing, I don't know. This is basically chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, right? I've just been doing whatever I want to do all up to this point. And I haven't had anybody really, but I ran into a lot of zealously religious people in college, which is what stirred all this. But they were very different. I had very Jewish friends and I had very Christian friends. And when I say very, I mean they were very serious about their vertical efforts, whatever that looked like to them. They were very different, you know. Okay, so I had some born-again Christians and I had some Orthodox Jews. Don't look very similar. Okay? But yet, I had nothing. They had something, and I needed to understand that. That's what he used to poke me. Okay? I need to understand this. I don't know why, because I didn't care for years interacting with them. But he poked me, which made me say, he's like, there's something going on with them you need to figure out. That was the poke. But that's where it says, well, if you're in the zombie stage or if you're in the walking cell, well, I was in the zombie stage until I started asking, seeking, and knocking. And as he showed me, I took in and started living instead of existing in the zombie stage. Okay? Because the zombie stage is just existing. You're just existing. You do what you do. You try to have as much fun or joy or pleasure as you can in it and minimize the misery and just get through it. Then you find out there's actually a path and a plan that leads to something a lot bigger, a lot better. And along the way, you even enjoy life a lot more when you apply the plan, okay? So now you're walking this out as opposed to being in the zombie stage. But of course, if you don't receive, even if he reveals, you can still be in the zombie stage. He can reveal it to you, but what do you do with it? Remember, I talked about this many times. Revelation is information being shared with you that you then need to receive and then you need to act upon it. Otherwise, it's not of any value. Okay? Because a lot of people are like, I want a revelation. Why? What are you going to do with it? I would rather say, I want to do what's pleasing to him and it needs a revelation so that I can receive something so that I can do it. Because now I'm wanting to do. I'm not just wanting information. Because people love to go listen to teachers that are going to reveal stuff to them. Usually stuff they can't do anything with anyway. It's stuff that supposedly is happening in the world and all these things that are happening. And really, you just sit there and it basically fear-mongers you and makes you upset. It stirs you up. So there's no point to that. I want revelation that's going to change me into him. So I try to give you every week. Okay, that's. But then, of course, if you don't receive it and then act upon it, then it was just information that went out into the air and was of no use. Okay? Okay, Shamish?
From Shelley Bell says, Rabbi, if we die before we are able to completely transform our inner self, will we have to repeat the grade, so to speak?
No, they sent you to New Jersey. No, I'm kidding. That was for mercy. I'm just teasing. If you failed, you go to Newark. Okay, she's like, I hate you. Well, I was going to say you need to get re-educated and go to Tech, but I didn't want to do that, so. Okay, enough personal jokes between me and Mercy, or actually me on Mercy. Okay, so, look, don't worry about your transformation. The test you need to pass is Deuteronomy 8:2. Okay, you're not necessarily going to complete perfectly the journey. What you need to do is be able to demonstrate perfectly your desire to complete the journey, which means you do it the best you can until you stop breathing. Okay? Deuteronomy 8:2 says what? That he walked us through this wilderness of the world, or them through the wilderness, you know, in the desert, like they literally did, the Israelites, to humble them and to test, to see, to prove whether or not their heart was to keep his commandments. That is what he's looking for. Not that you actually keep them perfectly, but that you want to and you try to and you make the effort to. And when you realize you're not, you get disappointed and you repent and you recognize that you're wrong and you need to get right. Understand? Okay. So Shelley Bell, that's a great question. But understand, don't feel like, what if I don't get far enough? It's an in-here transformation that's making the effort that matters. Okay? Yes, he knows your heart. And if he knows your heart was to do everything you could until you stopped breathing, that's what matters. Okay? It's not about that you actually got to the point where you got it all perfect. But can he trust you to always want to get it perfect? Can he trust you? So you know what the most important thing that he watches? When you mess up. He's not watching so much when you don't mess up. He's like, okay, good. You didn't mess up. That's good. I want to see what you do when you mess up. Because that's when I'm going to learn more about you. Oh, I'm proud of you when you do it. Okay, you looked at the label on the packaging. Good job. Okay? And you saw that it had something in it, no good. You put it back on the shelf. I'm proud of you. Good job. But I really want to see what happens when something goes sideways. And then it's revealed to you that you went in a wrong direction. Now, what do you do? What is it that you're going to do? How do you handle it? Do you own it? Do you fix it? Do you repent? Do you make tshuva? Right, teshuva, do you turn? Do you take a month to figure it out, or you do it within minutes when it's revealed to you? See, he's going to watch that much more closely. Oh, he's proud of you. Well done, good and trustworthy servant. You do things right. Yeah, but well, let me see what happens when you don't. Or when the temptation did not. These are the moments he really, because he has to learn how much he can trust you. Oh, but he knows everything. This is his choice. He chooses to want to see us do these things to demonstrate our trustworthiness. Okay? And by the way, how does he already know? Oh, but he knows everything. Well, how does he know everything? Not because, excuse me, like some seeing power or something. Time is not the same for him. It's already played out. He can be watching us right now where we are in this moment. He can also see us at the end of our life. He can see us before we were born. He sees it all at the same time. So he already sees your choices. But that's already how he knows you. Not because, well, he knows you, so then why do you have to do it? No, he knows you because he's already seen you do it. You understand? That's the key. Because some people say, well, why do I have to do it? He already knows me. Well, he already knows you because he already knows because he's seen. He knows what he's going to put you through, what he's allowed to happen, what he's caused to happen, and he's watched you respond to it. The end from the beginning. He already knows. Because we're thinking linearly as human beings. What if you're outside of time and space where all the things are happening at the same time, where he could be watching the end of your life already? And knows exactly, before you came out of the womb, he already knew what your end of your life was going to look like. He knew everything you were going to experience because he could, I hate to use the Doctor Strange, analogy, but when they saw that in the Avengers movie where he played every possible scenario from that moment forward by every choice he would have made, what it would come out, that's how the Creator actually can see everything in the universe. He can actually see everything that is all the permutations of what everybody's going to do based on everything that happens. So he already knows the things you will do. And the reason that Dr. Strange was able to pick his choice was why? He saw that the only choice that he thought he could make that got a good result was this one choice because he watched how everything played out. See, we do this a little bit if you're a chess player, you understand what I'm talking about. So when you play chess, I make a move expecting if I do that, you'll make a different move. And then I'll respond with this move, and I can play the whole thing out before I make the move, what I expect will likely happen. And if you're playing against a good player, you're probably right. Playing against a bad player, they may do something ridiculous you never expected, because it's the wrong move to begin with anyway, and you probably win relatively quickly. But the whole point is, when you watch the masters playing and they sit there thinking it through, they're saying, okay, if I move this piece, that kind of forces him to move this piece, and then I'm going to plan to do this, and they can play the whole thing out 12, 15 moves ahead. And it usually plays out the way they expect. And if it doesn't, then they have to adjust their plan. But it was always a possibility that there's more than one choice of what they would do. And if they do this, okay, and if they do that, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And then it gets more complex when it's 3 or 4 or 5 choices, and you have to play them out. Well, what if you see everything at the same time in every possible choice? That's what Yahweh can see everything, every choice. And so, yes, we should be concerned with getting to the point where we're complete. However, the complete that we really should be shooting for is the desire and effort to be complete and not worry about whether or not we get there. Okay? Don't beat yourself up for not getting there. Just redouble your efforts to fix it and move forward. I'm never going to get there. I'm just a lousy blah, blah, blah. Look, I messed up again. Or, messed up again. Get up, brush myself off, repent, put in 10 times more effort to not do it again. Or to do what I missed because I should have done it and I didn't do it. Okay? Instead of like, woe is me, beat up. No, you go before the Father. You repent. You cry before him and say, I am so sorry I messed up again, but I'm going to get this. My heart is to get this. I want to do what's right in your eyes. Okay? And don't wait days to get there feeling embarrassed and guilty. You get right down there and say, I own it. As we would say in the second, my bad, right? My bad. But when we say it with a commitment to fix it, all right? That's on me. I had a weak moment. I gave in. And I'm sorry. I'm going to do everything I can to strengthen that area so I don't have another weak moment. Okay? So, because most of us, when we say my bad, we're like, listen, you're just going to go over it. I just said it's my bad, so you should just let it go. Not if you're going to keep doing it. Okay? Next.
From Kristen Peterson says, question, comparing Ephesians 2, verses 1 through 2, 1 and 2, remembering where we came from, can you comment on Philippians 3, verse 13?
Oh, that's a very nice analogy. Look, first of all, you need to understand something about Shaul. Okay, Shaul says very much the same thing to everybody. Okay? Shaul is saying very much the same thing to the Corinthians, to the Philippians, to the Ephesians. He uses slightly different approaches and hits it in a slightly different way, but he's making the same points because these are all people he's responsible for, and he wants them to understand the same stuff. So in Philippians 3:13, it says, brothers, I don't count myself to have laid hold of it yet, but only this, forgetting what is behind and reaching out for what lies ahead. That's exactly the same thing, isn't it? Now, that was in one sentence, he says it, where in Ephesians, he's saying it over, chapters. Okay? He's actually painting that picture. This is you. This is where you were. This is where you're going. And so, absolutely, there's a connection there, okay?
Double D says, testing the word by the word, please point me to the verse or verses in the Tanakh that relates to Ephesians 1, verse 23, And the other one was one we haven't gone over yet.
Okay. Can't answer the first question about Ephesians 1:23 because I'd have to go look up some things for you, so I don't have that one popping up off the top of my head. So they're saying here, that was the other question it was on. That's not the one I'm looking at. Okay, so testing the word. Okay, Ephesians 1:23. When it talks about which is his body, the completeness of him who fills all in all. All right, so there are going to be things that we learn that are going to be coming out of the teach. Okay, you have to understand the writers and the teachers that you see, like Shaul, James, John, Peter, right? These are all writers of the Brit Chadashah, the New Testament. And they're writing from their understanding of the Tanakh and their understanding of Messiah and piecing things together. And so when we look at the way Israel was looked at as representing the Almighty, as the firstborn of the Almighty, I mean, because they were actually called the firstborn before Yeshua was called firstborn, as a type, that's the same kind of idea of his body, okay? The extension of him, the representation of him. Why would you say that we are his body? So, which is his body, the completeness of him? What's the complete? In other words, the goal was to make a group of people be like him. Well, isn't that what Israel did in Sinai? So, I mean, I can give you those verses as verses that would go with this. But in the Tanakh, when those writers are writing, like Moshe, they're talking about the nation, and they refer often to the nation as if it's an individual. This is my firstborn Israel. This is what's happening. That's actually what it's talking about to a large degree in Isaiah 53 with the people who want to say that Isaiah 53 is not about Messiah. Well, literally, it does talk about Israel as the firstborn in chapter 51 or 52 leading into 53. Okay? And so that is completely consistent. Shaul's just using a different way of wording the same concept by talking about the body, because the body is, we're parts of that body. Paul uses that often enough, you know, the eye and the hand, etc. We're all part of the body with a different function. That's his way of expressing the same concept. So hopefully that kind of goes along, okay? Rob?
Okay, Wayne Delaney, second question, says, what will the great second Exodus look like?
What would the great second Exodus look like? All right. By the way, let me just go back to, we are not, I'm going to go back to Double D's question real quickly here. The writers of the Brit Chadashah, the writers, if you don't understand Jewish writing, the writings of the sages, you don't understand about things like Gomorrah. Most people don't even know what Gomorrah is. You think it's a green lady from like the Guardians of the Galaxy or something. All right? Gomorrah is an important part of the writings of the sages, okay? If you don't understand the Midrash, if you don't understand some of the other writings, you don't understand how they would take the things of Tanakh, the things of your scripture, and then use their own stories to demonstrate and to paint the picture of how that could play out in their own words, which is exactly what you see Shaul doing, which Shaul would have known how to do as a student of Gamaliel, and he was trained in these ways, all right? And so I'm not going to have you guys go through a whole yeshiva of learning how to read the Gemara, okay? And the Gemara is basically the part of the Talmud where the rabbis are discussing and debating and arguing and making points about the Tanakh. See, most people think they understand the Talmud. They don't understand the Talmud. They don't understand what the Mishnah is. They don't understand what Gemara is. They think, oh, it's a bunch of the rules around the fences. You would think so, but that's not really what it looks like. It functions in that way to some degree, but the most robust part of it is just a bunch of rabbis going, Hashem, as they would say, said this. What did he mean? And they start talking about it. Well, this is what I think he meant, and this is what I thought he meant, and what do you think about it, and this is what I think about what you thought about what he meant. And let me use this story to kind of paint the picture of how I understand it. And so you have some of this happening with Shaul. Shaul's using, he likes to, for example, refer to the circumcision. Those are the circumcision, those are the uncircumcision. And the one thing he's not talking about is circumcision. But that's a phrase he likes to use to refer to those born in covenant who were circumcised on the eighth day and those who were grafting in who were not. The natural branches versus the unnat, the wild branches. Okay? It's his way of saying things. So sometimes when you ask for what's the Tanakh reference for things, sometimes it's not something that's a direct reference. It's a way of painting a picture of something that's a theme or clearly understood things from the Tanakh, then being brought forward in this person's own words and ways of describing it. Does that make sense? Okay? Again, had we had this kind of a background, we would see that this is a very common way to express your teaching of an understanding of something from the Tanakh to somebody. I said, do it through story, okay, which would be Midrash, right? Or to do it through, you know, making these allegories and other ways of putting it together. I do this all the time. You guys never complain when I do it. Okay, I give you something that you can relate to so that you can relate to what's happening in here with something that you could relate to in your life today. Okay? And so for whatever reason, Paul liked to use the body, athletics, and things like run the race to win the race. Where's that verse anywhere in the Tanakh? Nowhere, but it's just trying to paint a picture to understand that you're running this race. You're starting a journey that has to have an end, but you're going to try to get there to win. It's a mindset that's consistent with things that we have in the Tanakh, but it doesn't literally say that anywhere. Okay? So let's be careful with that. All right. Now, short of running you all through yeshiva and teaching you all of that stuff, which only confuse you anyway, and next thing you know, we're all going to end up running into Judaism, which I do not want you to do. But some of this, you'll just have to trust me, is because that's the style of the way that they were taught and the way that they did things, okay? All right. Let me just remind us all again, this book is not written to you. Nothing in this book is written to you. It's all written for you, though, okay? But because it wasn't written to you, the expectation that you would understand it simply because, you know, if I wrote you something, I know you, you know me, I can communicate, you'd understand everything I was saying. If I made a joke, if I made a reference, you'd know the reference. So here you have people writing hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, right? Paul's writing 2,000 years ago. And we're supposed to know the references that the Ephesian congregation understood when he says things? Now, thankfully, we can understand most of it, but some things we probably don't. They understood it quite well, but not so much for us because it wasn't written to us. It was written to them. We're getting to read it. I mean, he literally wrote this letter to them. It was written to them. But it's for our benefit. Paul even tells us these things, that all things that are written were for our benefit. There's examples for us that we can learn from. Okay. So I guess that's going to do it. Did you have anything else pressing back there?
No, just, well, the Wayne Delaney was asking what the second Exodus was going to look like, but.
So. The second Exodus, go to Millennium and Kingdom teaching. That should cover most of that. Okay. All right. Either that or in, again, with the identity, discovering your identity talks about it a little bit too. The regathering as we come to figure out who we are. All right. So let's go ahead and end it with that. I believe we have...